in the case of Majors against General Electric Company. Mr. Sams.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Stephen Sams, and I represent the plaintiff appellant in this matter, Ms. Renee Majors. This case is here on an appeal from a grant of summary judgment in the district court in Indianapolis, and we're asking that it be remanded and summary judgment be reversed. Ms. Majors was employed at the GE's Bloomington, Indiana refrigeration plant in 1972, at the age of 19. She worked there until she early retired at the age of 57 in 2009. Notably, she had 33 years of perfect attendance. December 2000, she sustained a workers' comp injury, and as a result, was put on medical restrictions. In the record, there are numerous copies of the forms that were filled out as she progressed through time. The restriction was moved from a temporary status to permanent status. It was reviewed at least a couple of times after that and deemed to be permanent. The issues that, in this case involve her disability discrimination claim under the ADA, and in this particular case, the amended ADA applies as the circumstances and facts of the case all occurred after the effective date of the new and amended ADA, January 1, 2009. First question is, what type of disability did she have under the definitions provided by the law? First one was the actual disability regarded as disability, record of disability. In this particular case, those are important because one of them, the regarded as disability, does not trigger the duty to accommodate. And
did the plaintiff have an actual disability in 2009, in your view?
Her restrictions involved no lifting over 20 pounds and no work at eye level above for the right arm.
And did your client have an actual disability in 2009, in your view?
Majors believe she did. Legally.
Okay. We've got a permanent impairment, PPI rating of 12%, right?
Correct.
How could a court impose liability on an employer for complying with an employee's permanent medical restrictions?
In this case, they did not accommodate her restrictions.
How should they have accommodated that? Well, I don't mean to interrupt your line of questioning, Judge.
Just thinking logically, if it's a lifting restriction, there's at least the obvious use of other staff, which she suggested, and that was flatly rejected.
But doesn't the case law say that you don't have to provide a helper for an accommodation?
It does, and there are other accommodations. Logically, one could think that some type of hoist or lifting device, something mechanical could be put in place that
was
would
assist her. Was any of that presented to the district court?
I'm sorry?
Was any of that presented to the district court? As evidence, it's your burden to show on a failure to accommodate claim that an accommodation was reasonable and available.
I believe that was.
Where do we find that in the district court record?
Would be in the appellant's brief. I can't pinpoint it at the moment.
Okay.
The other categories of disability regarded as not being of one of importance here, there was a record of impairment as well, and that goes back to the forms that were in her medical file. Over a period of 8 years, it was deemed that she had permanent restrictions. The trigger for the duty to accommodate is apparent in this case through either the actual disability or the record of disability. In arguing whether or not there was a duty to accommodate, GE suggests that Ms. Majors did not provide any suggestion of accommodation, and we've seen that that is not the case.
We know she made a proposal.
She did.
To help her.
Correct.
Anything else?
Nothing.
Okay.
And what's in derogation of the interactivity of the duty to accommodate is that GE didn't even come up with one suggestion. They flatly rejected hers, and that was the end of it. She applied for a promotion, applied twice for a promotion to a PMA position in 2009, once in May and once in October. She was disqualified for each of those positions because of her medical restrictions. It's interesting to note that GE wants it both ways here. They double-speak. When it's convenient for assessing the duty to accommodate and their duty related to that, they turn off.
Well, Mr. Sams, the same thing, the same accusation could be directed at you, where the plaintiff was saying she could do this work without accommodations, that her restrictions weren't really effective anymore, right?
Correct.
And she did take the payment for the PPI rating, right?
She did.
Okay. Did she ever ask to be reevaluated?
She did.
When? Where? Where do we find that?
Well, one obvious place is when she applied for the PMA position, which, by the way, had the same lifting requirements. It was termed intermittent lifting of heavy objects. There was no precision associated with that. There's no number given, 20 pounds, 30 pounds, whatever. But she was given that.
The PMA position or the
QCI
position?
She applied for the PMA position in May and October. Once it was temporary, once it was permanent. And after she applied for the temporary one in May, she spoke with the company nurse, Christoph, and indicated that these restrictions did not apply to her, that she could do the job.
Okay, Christoph checks the records and sees a PPI rating.
Permanent restrictions, yes.
Did your client ask for any doctor to evaluate her on those lifting restrictions in 2009?
She suggested that to the company nurse.
She suggested she be reevaluated, or just said this doesn't apply anymore?
That it didn't apply anymore.
Okay. So there's no medical evidence, no independent doctor, no request to have the company doctor reevaluate this permanent partial impairment.
Correct. And GE had a prime opportunity to do that between May and October when she applied for the same position twice. Knowing that she had been disqualified, the prudent thing would have been for GE to do a reevaluation and get to the bottom of it rather than relying on a permanent restriction that had been initiated some 8 years prior.
Why can't it reasonably rely on a permanent impairment finding?
Well, if you look at the forms that are in the record, one thing that jumps off the page is the re-exam checkbox. And that, in fact, happened a couple of times with Ms. Majors. In one instance, it was checked, a PRN, I believe, on as-needed basis. But it never was.
Well, maybe it was never needed. What tells us that? Well, go ahead.
I reserved my time. I think my white light went off.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, Mr. Sams.
Thank you.
Mr. Siegel.
May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Ken Seatman, and I represent the defendant, Appalachian General Electric Company. I want to first address immediately a couple of questions that Judge Hamilton asked, which was, where in the record is there any evidence of the issue of a request or analysis of hoist or lifting devices? There is none. It first appeared in appellant's brief in this court. The issue was never raised or suggested, and there's no record evidence on that issue. Second, though I believe Mr.
Can I just ask, Mr. Seaman, are these PMA positions, do they involve somebody in one location, or do they move around the plant?
They move around. And I think factually one of the background issues that's important for you, in 2000, as you understood from Ms. Sams in the briefing, for about 6 months, Ms. Majors worked as a purchased material auger. When she was in the job, her work restrictions were temporary. Some critical things about the background of that, there were 3,200 employees working in the plant at the time. There were many more stock handlers and others that were available to assist. More importantly, as specifically acknowledged by Ms. Majors on page 20 and page 179 of her deposition, she had a limited PMA role. There were five PMAs in the plant at the time. Her work involved only work with the plastic parts. She testified that she was not involved in working with the compressors, metal parts, or other heavier materials that worked in the refrigerator, except in circumstances when she had to cover for somebody who might be out for vacation or otherwise.
This is back in 2000.
Back in 2000. The job is different in 2009. There are 800 employees in the plant. There are two PMAs, and the PMAs are responsible for the entire facility. They have to do the lifting overall. The job description, the witness testimonies, the job analysis was thorough and clear that the job lifting of in excess of 20 pounds was required. This really is a fairly simple case. The company did well and above what it needed to do. It spoke with her. It spoke with a job. It spoke with a nurse. It spoke with a supervisor. It spoke with a job incumbent. Use an ergonomic technicians in a union shop who's on the employee's benefit. They all look at the job and they say, with a 20-pound lifting restriction, she can't do it. The only suggestions that were offered was, let's have somebody else do it for us. And as the judges noted and as Mr. Sams acknowledged, this court and all courts pretty much have said having someone else perform essential lifting is simply not reasonable as a matter of law.
Mr. Seaman, can I ask you about something in your brief that concerns me and also, frankly, in the district court's opinion? The suggestion seems to be that in deciding what's an essential function of the job, courts simply defer to the employer's judgment. My understanding is that under the relevant regulations and case law, the employer's judgment is an important factor. It's one of seven factors in the regulations, if I recall correctly, but it's only one factor. And we don't absolutely defer to an employer's judgment without effectively gutting the duty to accommodate.
Well, I would agree that that's correct, and I don't think that the court says that. I don't think the district court, and we don't say that totally. What the court says is there are job descriptions we look at. We talk to the people who are doing the job. All of those things were done. All of those things indicate clearly in this case that 20 pounds or more was an essential function. This court, though, has said plainly in a case, and I don't have the name in front of me right now that I cite in the brief, I quoted this court saying that it's not the court's position to interfere with the employer's assessment of what is.
The Lloyd case.
Right, the Lloyd case.
I'm suggesting that language may be a little too broad, that it is our job to second guess while also respecting all the other things that you have talked about that were developed in this case.
I would not say second guess, or maybe because we're talking about Monday morning quarterbacking. It's certainly this court's role to look at the facts and say.
So in this court, we talk about Tuesday morning quarterbacking.
Okay, very good. Certainly the court has a role, because otherwise you could have situations where an employer writes a job description that says have to be able to fly to the moon. Well, nobody can do that, and that's clearly not what's going on here. The court has a role, and that's an important role. But the role of that is to look at the facts in the case. We have a job description. There was actually, because the circumstance of Steve Howe leaving the job, there was an assessment done at that time talking about the lifting requirement that identified the various requirements of the job. On the facts in this case, there clearly can be no dispute about that the job requires this lifting, that Ms. Majors couldn't do it. We were left then with a situation of, do we take her word for it? Do we let her just say, oh, I don't have those restrictions anymore? That's not acceptable. An employer can't do that. And I think particularly here, Your Honor, ultimately Mr. Sams acknowledged, I believe when you were asking her, Judge Hamilton, that she did not ask to be reevaluated. And there is no record evidence to support that. That's not true. She simply said, those don't apply to me anymore. I can do the job. The company had a lot of evidence suggesting these restrictions were permanent. She got the PPI rating. The other things factually, you know, in February of 2004, Ms. Majors reported an injury lifting a compressor. Guess what? That compressor weighed over 20 pounds. I think particularly telling for your review in a practical matter and looking at it is deposition exhibit 25 to Ms. Majors' deposition. This was an email sent on May 11, 2009 from Tony Kristoff, the lead occupational health nurse who worked at the plant since 1998, and she was explaining to Joe Jones, the labor manager at the time, the rationale for the decision left off. And she notes in there that the permanent work restrictions had been in place, no greater than 20 pounds. She did a chart review, noted that there was another injury reported in 2004 for her working and lifting greater than 20 pounds. That would have been well outside of her restrictions. She noted that that brought up a problem. The plant has gone down to about 800 employees, and people were getting shuffled around. And so supervisors maybe didn't always know that the employees working directly with them might or might not have a restriction. So again, while Mr. Sams suggests that somehow GE did not believe or was not legitimate in these restrictions because some of the duties that she did in a quality control, Ms. Kristoff highlights again here, could you please make sure that whatever area Renee is assigned by business, that the BTL, that's business team leader or supervisor, is aware of her restrictions and also adhering to those restrictions. I did not recommend medically this position due to lifting of compressors, screw box, and other materials weighing over 20 pounds. I was told this is a reasonable portion of the position and is a definite violation of her permanent restrictions. The company acted reasonably in this case.
Let me just ask you about that. The reply brief, I think Ms. Majors says in the reply brief that that's hearsay because she wasn't working at that, and there are several I was told. Was there a motion to strike that in the summary judgment proceedings before the district court?
She never raised the issue until this court. And actually, we have a pending motion to supplement the record that was filed in the district court because the evidence is undisputed that that Tony Kristoff began working in the plant in 1998. And she was there and did not leave until 2003 and returned in 2005. In terms of the record in front of you, on page 6 of her deposition, which is a part of the record, Mr. Sams initially asked her where she was, and she said, I've been working at the Bloomington plant since 1998. In his brief, in his reply brief, he says it's hearsay because she was not working in the plant at the time. That is just not correct, even with the record that's in front of you. But we filed a motion to supplement the record in the court because on pages 13 and 14, Mr. Sams goes back and asks Ms. Kristoff about her job history. In those two pages of the deposition, she testifies, I started working at the Bloomington plant as a contracted nurse in 1998. She worked with Ms. Majors when she had the shoulder injury in 2000.
So are we waiting for Judge McKinney to...
We're waiting, yes. I actually mistakenly initially filed it with this court and the court, and so that is back there. But there's no dispute that Ms. Kristoff was in the plant at all relevant times prior to at the time in 2005.
Mr. Siebman, I'd like to ask you about one other thing here. It really has to do with the effects of the ADA Amendments Act. As to whether a significant lifting restriction like a 20-pound limit, case of Coke or something like that, for most of us it's a pretty good measure, whether that's a substantially limiting impairment. You've cited case law in your brief from prior to the Amendments Act. Do you think that's still good law in light of the amendments, and if so, why?
I think this court's decision in Shredney, and I believe Zuhurik was the case that had been cited before that, the 20-pound lifting restriction is not sufficiently substantial, even under the amended law. Clearly, lifting, we know now, is a major life activity. But they didn't change the word substantial. They gave the court, they said, look, we want to be more friendly to employees in these circumstances in defining what is a disability. There has to be some meaning, though, to substantial, a 20-pound lifting restriction without any evidence more about how that might limit or otherwise interfere with her. I don't think that that is sufficient, and I believe that this Court's decision in Zaharenz is still good law at 20 pounds. Where do we draw that line? It's difficult to say. I think in Mays versus Principi, the Court said a 10-pound lifting restriction was not, I believe, in the case, and frankly, that's probably getting to be pretty close. But I think 20 pounds, particularly when the evidence, the only evidence that's there in the record, there's nothing that had interfered her in any other way. She didn't offer evidence about how it might impact her other jobs and moving on. So I think a 20-pound lifting restriction certainly is debatable and supportable that the existing one.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further? Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Sams? You have about 45 seconds.
In closing, Your Honors, I would just ask the Court to be aware of the following things in their consideration. One is the precision indicated by Mr. Seidman in the job descriptions is not present. It's intermittent lifting of heavy objects. There's no 20-pound specification. GE refuses to acknowledge the broader protection provided by the amended ADA using old case law. They were asked to provide some indication of undue hardship and how much it would cost. They didn't even do that. The QCI jobs were different when it comes to the similarly situated folks. The job descriptions for the code 9018 were not presented when that could have easily resolved the issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.